Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, June 4th. 5 weeks ago, I was in Paris, France, when word came that Osama bin Laden had been killed. I didn't respond in my column until I returned in my May 7th Week in Review. You then undoubtedly noticed my tone was a bit subdued, as much as I documented the praise for our president in making the decision to take out the Al-Qaeda leader and terrorist. The reason is I had a lot of other things on my mind, as in I kept thinking, those celebrating can enjoy the moment, but the world's problems go far beyond this one man, and the issues are frankly more serious than Al-Qaeda, assuming they can be prevented from getting their hands on a weapon of mass destruction. The Arab Spring, for starters, on balance, is hardly cause for celebration. Name one major success story thus far. And if you say Egypt, you just don't get it. The upcoming parliamentary elections there, currently slated for September, do not look promising for the West. While I have been writing for months now that Israel is increasingly encircled, far more than before, a point brought home recently by Benjamin Netanyahu, with his titanic trip to Washington. I continue to maintain, however, as I have since the end of last year, that the two big issues on the geopolitical front that could totally cause mayhem are Pakistan and Lebanon, and by inference, Iran. I stick to this, as has been proven with recent Taliban attacks that were carried out with inside help. It is more apparent than ever that the Taliban has the ability to decapitate the Pakistani government, which would lead to war with India. Regarding Lebanon, given certain circumstances, Tehran just has to give the okay, and Hezbollah will start another far more fearsome war with Israel, only this time the battle would undoubtedly be joined on other fronts. That's just the geopolitics of today and the items that stand out. Then there is the ongoing European debt crisis that before it's finished threatens to not only transform the European Union and do a number on some of the world's leading banks, but it could transform the continent in other ways, which is why I have written so much on the immigration issue and how it's tied closely to the monetary crisis. The far right is rising across Europe, and if various economies don't start exhibiting strong growth from north to south, the kinds of protests you have seen in Greece and Spain thus far are nothing compared to what is to come. Of course, the odds of the needed strong growth are also nil. This week saw a slew of data on manufacturing from around the world, and I'll be damned if I could find a single silver lining. Even in a case such as with China's Purchasing Managers Index for May, 52.0 versus expectations of 51.7, it was still down from April's reading of 52.9. This was about the best case. The 17-nation Eurozone's May PMI came in at 54.6 versus 58 in April. Non-Euro Britain was at 52.1 versus April's 54.4. Russia was nearing stagnation at 50.7. Here in the U.S., the PMI was 53.5 versus April's 60.4 and a projection of 57.6. Another huge miss on the data for economists. Heck, the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index for May was 56.6 versus 67.6 in April, and a projected 62. Factory orders for April in this country were down 1.2%. And to top it off, the May employment data for the U.S. revealed the economy created all 54,000 jobs versus last month's revised 232,000, and again, way off the 185,000 projection. In the private sector, April's job growth was 254,000. May's was just 83,000. The unemployment rate ticked up from 9 to 9.1%. What is my mantra around here? Wait 24 hours. Since Osama bin Laden was killed, you cannot point to another piece of good news anywhere in the world. Go ahead, try. Think about the fact that in Afghanistan, since bin Laden's death, more than 400 U.S. servicemen and women have been injured and over 20 killed. Hundreds of innocents have been killed in Syria in the last 5 weeks of protests. Hundreds in Pakistan. Hundreds in Yemen, a critical hotspot. And back to Europe, out of nowhere, you have an E. coli outbreak, a virulent strain never seen before by global health officials that not only has killed at least 18, as I go to post, but it has sickened almost 2,000. Some say the toll is 10 times that figure, and more importantly, 500 have developed a rare kidney failure complication that, if it doesn't lead to death, will cause health problems in those individuals the rest of their lives. Obviously, no one could have forecast such a disaster, but this is sheer terror for Europeans, especially Germans, where the outbreak is centered, that rivals anything Al-Qaeda and its ilk could come up with. This isn't a case of tainted Tylenol. This is the food supply, and what makes it even worse is scientists still haven't found the source. No identified source, but Spain has been fingered nonetheless as the leading suspect for the tainted cucumbers, tomatoes, and lettuce, and so no one is accepting such produce from Spain, which is screaming bloody murder, is now going to suffer losses in the billions before all is said and done, with some 70,000 jobs impacted at a time the nation already has 21% unemployment and is increasingly looked at as the next shoe to drop after Greece, Ireland, and Portugal in the debt crisis. It's incredibly depressing for those of us with half a brain who follow the news. Plus, consider this last fact. This E. coli strain is at risk of spreading from person to person just through close contact, according to the British Health Protection Agency, which issued such a warning on Thursday. This is an outbreak unlike any other at the worst possible time in terms of euro area confidence. As for Greece and its financial difficulties, the European Union and International Monetary Fund will pay the next installment under last year's $155 billion bailout, convinced Greece is serious about its latest round of budget cuts and privatization plans, but have put off for another few weeks a second aid package as details are worked out. This, as Moody's raised the probability of a default to 50%, while other experts say the prospects are far higher. EU, European Central Bank officials are adamant there will be no restructuring because they know the impact this would have on some of the largest financial institutions and governments that are holding Greek crapola. While what's also increasingly clear is that nothing the EU, ECB, and IMF come up with will work because Greece is not going to see the kind of explosive growth needed, not just to meet its debt obligations, but also to engender confidence in the market to finance future debt offerings. Instead of just jettisoning Greece from the Eurozone, why not stick it on the last space shuttle and leave it on the International Space Station? That's a deal the citizenry of Germany and Finland, among others, could agree to. As for Ireland, the government keeps saying the economy will grow this year, while Ernst & Young sees a decline in activity of 2.3%. Another 35,000 are expected to emigrate over spreading fears there. And Denmark entered recession with its second straight down quarter. Q4 GDP was down 0.2%, Q1 down 0.2%. This was unexpected. But Germany's unemployment rate fell to 7% in May. Martin Wolf, Financial Times. Hold on one second here. The Eurozone confronts a choice between two intolerable options, either default and partial dissolution or open-ended official support. The existence of this choice proves that an enduring union will at the very least need deeper financial integration and greater fiscal support than was originally envisaged. How will the politics of these choices now play out? I truly have no idea. I wonder whether anybody does. Turning to the U.S., with the above-noted economic data, along with further distressing news on the housing front from the folks at S&P, Case-Shiller, which showed new lows in home prices by their calculation for the quarter ending March, and thereby a double dip. I'm not ready to call it that myself officially, but it's splitting hairs. What is readily apparent is that QE2 has been a miserable failure. The purpose of Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's program was to keep interest rates low so as to juice housing and encourage investment, both in stocks and other assets, as well as plant and equipment, which would lead to more hiring. Instead, job growth has been anemic given how far we had fallen. Housing is dead in the water, and while asset prices and corporate profits are up, again, the point of QE2 was to juice housing in the job market. Additionally, and never to be discounted, is the fact that Bernanke has totally screwed savers, particularly the elderly. Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City President Thomas Hoenig said the U.S. needs to raise interest rates to encourage individuals to save and avoid future asset bubbles. But Honig, the central bank's longest-serving policy member, doesn't have a vote this year. Honig said, I'm not advocating for tight monetary policy, but I do think we have to get off of zero if we want to avoid repeating some of the mistakes of the past with a very easy credit environment. As for the debate over raising the debt ceiling, this week Moody's said it would put the U.S. government's AAA credit rating under review for a downgrade unless progress is made on increasing the debt limit by mid-July. Many poo-poo this. They're wrong to do so. Peggy Noonan, Wall Street Journal. The debate in Washington is serious as a heart attack, where the United States should raise its debt ceiling so it can borrow more money to stay afloat. The statutory ceiling on our national debt, our legal borrowing limit, is $14.3 trillion. That limit was reached, according to the Treasury Department, on May 16. Treasury says it can make due until early August, when the ceiling must be raised by $2.4 trillion. Congressional Republicans have made their stand clear. They will agree to raise the limit only if it is accompanied by spending cuts or reforms. The Democrats want to raise the ceiling, period. The Republicans are being hardline because of the base, and the base is hardline for two reasons. First, we are in an unprecedented debt crisis. Second, the past 40 years have taught them that if dramatic action is not taken to staunch spending, Congress will spend more. Something is needed to shock the system. If Republicans can get the White House to cut where the money is, Medicare, then Medicare and all controversy over the Bryan plan will be taken off the table as an issue in the 2012 election. This would not be good for Democrats. Democrats, in turn, would likely make some cuts in spending if Republicans agree to some tax increases. But that would take a great Republican issue off the table. So now what? Noonan continues. Democrats are right that the debt ceiling must be raised. Republicans are right that the decision to raise the debt ceiling must be accompanied by reforms or cuts to spending that equal or exceed the amount of the raise, $2.4 trillion. Here's why. Default is unthinkable. We are the United States of America and we pay our bills. Raising the ceiling without attempting to control spending is a depressing and wearying thought. It will avert crisis, yes, but there would be no gain in it beyond that. It would demonstrate to the world that we are not capable of taking necessary steps to dig our way out of the spending mess. It would mean things just continue as they are. Well, what about the president? Ms. Noonan praises Bill Clinton's skills in bringing both sides together, saying, he understood why conservatives think what they think because he was raised in the South. He was surrounded by them, and he wasn't by nature an ideologue. And Obama? Noonan concludes, Barack Obama's different, not a political practitioner really, but something else, and not a warm-blooded animal, but a cool, chill character, a fish who sits deep in the tank and stares stilly at the other fish. He doesn't know how to confuse his foes with outreach, with phone calls, jokes, affection. He doesn't leave them saying, as Reagan did, I just can't help it, I like the guy. And because he can't confuse them or reach them, they more readily coalesce around their own explanation of him, socialist destroyer. This isn't good and has had an impact on the president's contacts with Republicans, and it's added an edge to an emerging campaign theme among them. 2 years ago, I wrote of Clara Booth Luce's observation that all presidents have a sentence. He fought to hold the Union together and end slavery. He brought America through economic collapse and a world war. You didn't have to be told it was Lincoln or FDR. I said that Mr. Obama didn't understand his sentence, but Republicans now think they know it. Four words. He made it worse. Obama inherited financial collapse, deficits, and debt. He inherited a broken political culture. These things weren't his fault, but through his decisions, he made them all worse. That was Peggy Noonan in her Wall Street Journal op-ed. Well, Obama at least agreed to play golf with House Speaker Boehner in 2 weeks. I guess that's a start. The Dow Jones fell for a fifth straight week, the longest such skid since 2004, which I kind of find remarkable. All the bad economic news took its toll, and the three major averages, the Dow, S&P 500, and NASDAQ, all fell the same 2.3%. The Dow remains up 5% for the year, but the other two are up just 3%. The dollar got crushed on Friday on word EU officials were pulling out the stops for Greece, which is a total crock, but we'll let them have a few weeks off as they play their shell game. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday, June 11th, for further details. You can click on this Stocks and News or go to stocksandnews.com. Click on Week in Review. Have a good one. Take care.